Well, how's it going, everybody? Good? My name's Josh. I'm one of the pastors here on the Fusion team. Fusion is our 18 to 35-year-old ministry here at Christian Assembly. And just really quickly, the reason we have an 18 to 35-year-old ministry is there are 10,000 18 to 35-year-olds within 5,000 feet of where we're at right now. And we want this to be a place where they can find a home, where they can interact with other people their age, and where they can find out more about Jesus. We're really big into that. And so if you're here and you're checking us out and you're wondering what we're about, that's what we're about. And especially, I just want to say, if you're here and you're investigating faith, someone invited you, you've been resisting, you said yes, or you just showed up out of nowhere, you're like, all right, I'm going to give this Jesus thing a try. I just want to let you know, I'm so glad you're here. I think that takes a lot of guts. There's been times that I've visited other churches, especially of other faiths, and it's always really nerve-wracking. You never know what you're going to get into. And so if that is you here tonight, I just want to say thank you for being here. Thank you for trusting us enough to show up. Nothing creepy will happen. We promise you that. Or like nothing overtly creepy will happen. We promise you that. We're just really, really glad that you're here. Like John said, we are going through the story, and we've been in this for about 83,000 weeks, I think now is where we're at, week 83,000. Tonight, we are actually going to be jumping into the story of Esther, which I'm really excited about. All right, we have three Esther fans. That got obligatory on me really fast. I'm really excited about that tonight, and we're just going to dive right in. But before we do that, I would love for us just take a second to stop and be still and invite God to speak to us. So if you would pray with me really quick. And we're just going to start off by having about 30 seconds of silence, and this is just so we can sort of like get still and quiet. And in this silence, I would just encourage you to turn your attention toward God, to be aware of his presence, that he's here with you, that we are not going through some sort of routine or going about the thing that we always do, that God, whether or not we're aware of it, is here with us right now. And to just pray a simple prayer to him, say, God, would you speak to me tonight? And if you're like me, I show up at these things a lot, at services, with a lot of baggage. And I think that's true of me tonight. I'm coming in with a lot of things on my mind, a lot of stuff that I'm dealing with. Honestly, some unconfessed sin probably that I've been wrestling with today. And so if there's anything that you just need to have an honest conversation about with God, anxiety, frustration, bitterness, whatever, just something you want to get out of the way before we jump into the talk tonight, then just offer that up to God. Imagine yourself giving it to him and say, could you move this out of the way so I can hear from you? And if you don't mind, would you pray for me that God would speak through me tonight, that he would use me to draw attention to him? God, you are our Savior, our Deliverer, and our Healer. All the praise and the glory goes to you. You're the name above all names. You're the hero of the story, not us. It's all about you, whether we realize it or not, whether we remember it or not. It's all about you. You are active and involved in our world. Would you open up our eyes tonight to see where you're at work? And we pray all this in your name. Amen. So like I said, tonight we're just going to dive right in. And so to do that, I want to catch you up before we get into the story of this woman named Esther. I want to catch us up and remind us of where we're at. So to set the scene, God's chosen people, the Hebrew people, he calls them out of Egypt. He says, I am going to use you to be a light to the world. The good news of who I am is going to go to all nations through you. And then they promptly begin forgetting who God is and screwing it up. God keeps saying, don't do that. Sometimes they listen. Then it gets to the point where they really don't. and God eventually allows the surrounding countries to carry them off into captivity. But he says in that, there's going to come a rescue. I'm not going to leave you there. I am still ultimately going to use you to be a light through all the nations. But our story tonight takes place while most of the Israelite people are still very much in captivity. And so when we looked at Daniel a couple weeks ago, it was the Babylonian Empire. Then the Babylonians got taken over by the Persians. Now for our story tonight, they're in charge. But we still have tons of people who for decades now have been living in captivity, waiting for God, and there's still no deliverance. The promise of Israel being God's chosen people at this point in time still seems kind of laughable. But there are some who in this culture are trying to hold on to their identity. They're trying to hold on to being servants of the one true God. If you've ever seen the musical Fiddler on the Roof, that tension of Jewish people trying to live in a different culture without losing what makes them unique, that kind of illustrates that. That's probably what it was like for a lot of these Jewish people. And that's the culture that Esther is born into. We don't know a ton about Esther. We do know that when she was probably pretty young, both of her parents died, and that her older cousin Mordecai stepped in as her care provider. And it's when Esther was probably, we don't know for sure, but probably a teenager that our story picks up. And so the king of all of Persia decides to throw this lavish party. And guys, when I say lavish party, I'm not talking about like a dance party at someone's house for a night. We are talking about like when they party, they take it seriously. So we're talking like a week-long event, multiple days of partying, because the king, as we're about to discover, he's kind of a buffoon in this story a little bit. He is not looked at very highly. He's kind of, I don't like to throw the word idiot out, but like the story is not kind to him. But this one thing apparently he can do well is throw parties. And so the king and all of his friends, who also don't like using the word idiot, but they're not looked at very highly in this story, the king and all of his friends are hanging out and partying together. And when you get people prone to poor judgment drinking for multiple days on end, they come up with bad ideas. And so the king comes up with this brilliant idea. He's like, my queen Vashti, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to send to her and have her dress herself all up, look as beautiful as she can. Then I'm going to basically have her parade around in front of my friends so that they can be impressed with how attractive she is. For some reason, Vashti doesn't like this idea. And so she says no. And the king literally has no idea what to do with this, because the idea that a woman might have a thought of her own, this is mind-boggling to him. And so he turns to his other bro friends and he talks to them. And he's like, guys, what do I do? She won't come. And the friends, and this is all in the story, you can read this, this is real. And all of his friends are like, oh my gosh, man, here's the deal. You got to do something about this, because if you don't, this is in there, I swear, I'm not making this up. Our wives are going to hear about it, then they won't obey us. And then like, the kingdom's going to fall apart. And so the king, listening to this incredibly wise counsel, kicks his wife out. He's like, you're no longer queen, she's gone, bye-bye Vashti. And then the king, after a period of time, gets... this is a family audience, so we're going to use the word lonely. The king gets lonely. And again, this is all in there, guys. You can look it up for yourself. And he basically decides, like, he goes to his advisors, because they've been just batting 1,000, and he says, guys, what should I do? And they're like, well, here's the deal. We're going to get, like, all the attractive women that live in the kingdom. We're going to get them all together. We're going to parade them around in front of you. You can sleep with all of them if you want to, and then you can pick the one that you like best. Can you imagine a culture that is just so debased, treats women so poorly, they would participate in something like this? We've come a long ways, guys. Now, here's the deal. Up until this point, this is largely how I've taught the story quite a few times. I've always looked at it from a certain perspective, and I've really focused on it kind of more the way I've been talking about up till now. But recently, and this is actually, of course, it took one of the women on our staff made a comment that changed my perspective on it, and I had just never looked at it this way before. And she helped me see this story from the perspective of Esther. And when you turn the corner and look at it that way, the story becomes very different. Because here's this teenage girl who's a virgin, because that's a part of this whole parade that's happening. She's a teenager. She's trying to be a God-fearing Jewish woman. And she hears this story about this temperamental king that for no good reason banished his queen. And now, against her will, because no part of this is voluntary, is turned into this disgusting beauty contest, is forced to sleep with this king, and then wins. And the question is, where's God in all this? And you know what's interesting about the book of Esther? Is that God, and this is the only book in the Bible that's like this, God isn't actually directly mentioned once in the entire book. It's the only book of the Bible that's like that. God is never directly mentioned or addressed in the entire book of Esther. And it's almost as though the writer of Esther is kind of trying to draw our attention through that absence of the question of where is God in all of this? This is for sure the question that Esther is asking in this moment. And I want to ask you the question tonight. Have you ever wondered, where is God right now? As tragedy, unexpected illness, financial collapse happens, God, where are you? A prayer that you've been praying for a long time in faith, believing that God is going to answer it, and yet that prayer just continually goes unanswered. You're wondering, where is God? Where did he go? Or maybe for some of you tonight, if we're honest, it's not really about you. There's not like this excuse of like tragedy or illness or unanswered prayer. We just kind of like lost God somewhere along the way. You know how like you have your keys and then you lay them down and then you have to like, where did I put my keys? We do that with kind of with God. It's like all of a sudden we just placed God down somewhere and we walked away and we're like, I don't remember what I did with him. And you're here tonight and you're just kind of trying to think like, when's the last time I actually saw God moving in my life? When's the last time that I actually interacted with him? When's the last time that I sensed him moving and speaking to me? When's the last time that I made time in my life for him? And this is how we're looking at the Esther story, through the absence of God, through people who are having a hard time seeing where God is. The world is spinning, events are unfolding. Esther's life is just going in this really weird and probably pretty tragic and terrible direction for her. And God seems nowhere. So as the story goes on, there's this man named Haman. Haman becomes a big shot in the kingdom. Matter of fact, he's like the king's right-hand guy. And everyone, of course, because he's a big shot, everyone's just like worshiping this dude. Everywhere he goes, people are just, you're the best, you're amazing. But Mordecai, who is Esther's older cousin, refuses to do any of that. He's just like, there's no way. And so Haman gets really, really upset at Mordecai. And Haman, being the level-headed guy that he is, says, I hate Mordecai. Mordecai's a Jew. I'm going to kill all the Jews. Which, he's got some issues. And so Haman goes to the king. Again, our king, the guy is just really good at making responsible choices. And like in no time, in one paragraph, talks the king into issuing this decree that is going to massacre all of the Jewish people living in all of the city of Susa. And so we'll pick this up. This is actually from the story. We'll have this up on the screen. It says this. Dispatches were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces with the order to destroy, kill, and annihilate all the Jews, young and old, women and children, on a single day. The couriers went out, spurred on by the king's command, and the edict was issued in the citadel of Susa. The king and Haman, however, sat down to drink, but the city of Susa was bewildered. So Mordecai hears about this. And he enters into the stage of mourning, and he rips his clothes, and he covers himself in sackcloth and ashes, and he's publicly mourning around the temple. And Esther hears about it and begs him to stop. And Mordecai responds and he says this. He tells Esther, you need to go before the king and you need to plead our case for us. But there's this rule that if you go before the king unsummoned, that can lead to death. And the reason that Esther has cause to worry is that because shortly after she became the queen, the king just kind of forgot about her. She became a discarded plaything. So she's just been hanging out for days, for weeks, with nothing to do, with just sitting around. And so at first, when Mordecai says, you have to go before the king and plead the case, Esther resists, and she says this. We'll have this up on the screen as well. All the king's officials and the people of the royal provinces know that for any man or woman who approaches the king in the inner court without being summoned by the king has but one law, that they be put to death unless the king extends the gold scepter to them and spares their lives. But 30 days have passed since I was called to go to the king. And so again, from Esther's point of view, she cannot help but see her life through the absence of divine providence, the absence of God. She's looking at her story and saying, it's like, I hear what you're saying, but I'm in a place where God seems to have abandoned me here. I'm left here. I'm isolated here. And Mordecai responds with such wisdom, and he says this, do not think that because you are in the king's house, you alone of all the Jews will escape. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place. But you and your father's family will perish. And this is the key line. This part's like the key part we're going to zone in on. And who knows but that you have come to your royal position for such a time as this. So what's Mordecai doing here? He's reframing the story of Esther's life. Esther, who has only been able to see the absence of God, Mordecai steps into her story and says, have you ever thought about the fact that in the middle of this tragedy, in the middle of these events, in the middle where it seems like God has left you, in the middle of this moment where you feel isolated and alone, have you considered the fact that there's a God moving behind the scenes of all of this? He's reframing the narrative of Esther's life. He's telling her there's a bigger story that's happening right now. From Mordecai's perspective, he sees the hand of God happening behind the scenes. Mordecai is able to look at Esther's story from a different perspective. And this is kind of the first thing we're going to look at in your notes tonight. Because here's the deal. There's a second side to every story. There's a second side to every story. I learned this really clearly whenever I worked with high school students for a long time. And high school students love to come and tell you about all like the stuff that's happening in their life that's not fair. And so they'll come, and they'll talk to me like, my parents, like you wouldn't believe it. And they start telling me the story. After a while, I'm like, oh man, that's bad. Your parents, what's wrong with them? And it's like, that's really mean and unjustified. And then like later on, I find like, oh, you tried to burn down your school. Like, yeah, it makes sense that you got punished. And it's like, I just got to the point where I'm like, there's a second side to every story. Some of you have had this, right? Like someone comes to you and they're like, can you believe that so-and-so did this to me? You're like, oh, so-and-so's terrible. And like the whole story of who that person is, you're like, ah, they're a bad person. And then you find out the other side of the story and you realize, oh man, there's a completely different way of seeing this. There's always a second side to the story. And this is absolutely true with God's stuff. There's always a second spiritual side to the story because it's so easy for us to lose sight of how our story looks from God's perspective. So recently, Christina, she had to go to the dentist, and I thought it was like, oh, we're going to the dentist for like a cavity. Well, yeah, it happens. No. It's like, it turns out there's like a $1,700 dentist bill that came back. I'm like, God, where are you? You know, it's like, really quickly enter into this like crisis of faith moment. I'm like, wait a minute. And I stopped. And I was like, what's the second side to this story? I was like, well, I have a healthy family, a healthy 6-month-old child. We have dental insurance. Also, local anesthesia. Do you know that we exist in this tiny window of human experience where local anesthesia exists? Have you ever thought about that? Like, no other humans for almost all of human history have that. We have local anesthetics. Do you know how much better life is because of that? Because here's the deal. We are all standing in the goodness of God and we don't even realize it. In the book of James, we're told this, that every good and perfect gift comes from our Father in heaven. This means anything that's good in our life comes from him. And yet we've become so quick to not even see those things as being good things. And so I decided to make a list. And this is like, I was like, as many things as I can get in like 5 minutes or something like that. Like, I'm just gonna make a list. Like, what are the good things in my life right now? It's like, okay, my kid Caleb, my 6-month-old Caleb, it's a good thing. Caleb sleeping through the night for the first time ever. A phenomenal thing. My wife, Christina, who's like way more sweet and patient and reasonable than she has any business being with me, because I'm a mess, guys. You don't even know. Like, our house, we love our house. Like, we specifically prayed before we came out here that God would give us a place that we could, like, host other people and a place that would just, and it's like we saw it and immediately, like, we can totally spend the next several years of our life here. I wanted, like, a porch that I could, like, drink coffee on and just, like, stare at things. I got a porch that I can stare at things. And speaking of coffee, guys, I just recently got a burr grinder for my coffee, changed the whole dynamic of my coffee experience. I'm very grateful for coffee right now. I love my team that I get to work with, the Fusion team. Every single day, I get to show up and work with this team of people that are just, they love Jesus and they're really talented and we just have fun together. And they're who I get to work with. I love our church. I love the fact that this is a church where the leadership at the from the very top all the way on down is intentional about trying to model a humility and a vibe that says we are not any better than anyone else, that we are all broken, messed up people who are being changed by Jesus. And it was so refreshing to be a part of a church culture like that. I love living in LA. I love the culture and the food and the weathers and the mountains and the sunshine. I caught myself complaining for 5 seconds about the weather today. And immediately had to stop and be like, you stop that. That is not okay behavior. Do you know what the weather is like everywhere else in the world? It's not good. And it's like, I could go on and on and on about all this small stuff that I love, but it's like every single one of those is a gift straight from God. And there's two options and choices that I have in my life. I can see them as random threads that just so happen to exist. Or intentional blessings given to me by a good God. Which perspective do you have? Here's how you know if you see the good things in your life as random threads or as intentionally good gifts. Because here's the deal. Good gifts plus a God-centered perspective turns into gratitude. Good gifts plus a God-centered perspective leads to gratitude. How grateful are you right now? In your life, are you quick to complain? Are you quick to talk about how you're not getting what's yours? Or just joy and gratitude and thankfulness spill out of you? Because the flip side of it is this, is that good gifts plus a me-centered perspective equals entitlement. That good gifts plus a me-centered perspective equals entitlement. I recently saw, and it was meant innocently, no one ever means anything by it, but someone will like post something good that happens on Facebook and someone will comment with like, you deserve this, you deserve this. And I'm like, it bugs me so much. I'm like, don't say that. Like, not because that person's bad, but because one, we don't, any of us deserve anything. Like, we take for granted the fact that there should be goodness in life. One, we don't deserve it. Two, imagine if someone cared enough about you to think of like a really specific gift that they knew you would like and they spent a lot of money and time on it and then they gave it to you, said, oh, thank you, I really deserved this. How terrible is that? And yet that's what we do all the time with all the good gifts that God has poured out on our life. We have a sense of entitlement about it. We get used to it. We think it should always be there. The fact that the laws of the universe continue to function in a normal way that is predictable is a good thing. You know, like quantum mechanics, like there's a whole theory out there that says it doesn't make sense that gravity should always work the way that it works. Like sometimes gravity should just like disappear for a second. The fact that that doesn't happen, we actually aren't really entirely sure why. The fact that we live in a world that has a certain amount of order and predictability to it, all of this is a gift from God. Entitlement steals from us a God-centered perspective and robs us of our joy. So which perspective are you looking at your life through tonight? Do you see your life through the lens of gratitude or through the lens of entitlement? Do you see the good things in your life and do you see God in the story of the good things? Or have you removed him from it and you can't see him there at all and it's leading you to entitlement? But I want to turn a little bit of a corner here too. Because for some of you tonight, this isn't about good things and it's not about entitlement. For some of you tonight, you really are. There's some of you tonight, and you're in the middle of it right now, of disappointment, of heartbreak, of tragedy. And some of you tonight, like there's a lot of you tonight, if I had to guess, who came in here, and you're in a lot of pain. It might be physical or spiritual or emotional. And maybe you're wondering, like, well, where's the good in this? Like, where is God in the middle of this? Because there's nothing good about it. I want to show you a picture of something. We'll throw the first picture up here on the screen. This is the backside of a tapestry. And if you look up at it, you see a lot of different colored threads. You see light threads, and you see sort of like the darker shades of blue, and then you see some really dark threads scattered throughout there. And so you have all this lightness and darkness and everything in between, but there doesn't seem to be a lot of order to it. You just have all these different threads that seem to be all jumbled together. And yet, when we go to the next picture up here, if we can throw that up on the screen, what we find out is that all the random threads of our life, all the random threads in this tapestry have been woven together to create this picture that was impossible to see from the backside. Here's the deal. I want to be careful about this. Because like sometimes Christians will come up to people who are in pain and they say really dumb things. They say things like, well, everything happens for a reason. Like, I'm going to punch you in the face for a reason. But it's not, I don't, because here's the deal. God says that his kingdom is coming to make things right again. He is coming, the purpose and plan of his kingdom is to get rid of sickness and death and pain and brokenness and despair and heartache and all that stuff. And it says that at the end of the story that God is going to wipe every tear away from his eye. And there are some people who are going to say that God deliberately is like the author of bad things. And I personally, they'll try to back it up biblically. I can't buy into that perspective. But what I can believe is this. I don't think that everything happens for a purpose. I think that God breathes a purpose into everything that happens. And those are two very different things. I believe that there is a God who is able to take the tapestry of our lives and to take the light threads and the dark threads, to take the joys and to take the pains, to take the times where things are good, the sunshine days and the dark days, to take all of the stuff that happens and to breathe purpose into it and to weave it in to the story of our lives and weave it into something beautiful. And for those of you who have been on this faith journey for a while, you may have seen this a little bit. For some of you, there is an anger that used to be inside of some of you. And it was an anger that came from a lot of pain from your past. But God, over the years, has been slowly but surely healing the source of that anger. And now you're someone who's peaceful and under control, and you bring this like gentleness with you into moments and into conversations. Some of you used to be so insecure, and you're just constantly in every moment thinking about, I wonder what this person thinks about me. I wonder if they like me. I wonder if I'm okay. But God has slowly but surely been giving you a sense of confidence in who you are. And now when you step into other conversations, you're not always thinking about yourself. You're able to put yourself aside and think, I wonder what God's doing in this conversation right now and in that moment, and be a source of joy and healing to other insecure people around you. Some of you have had deep feelings of abandonment and loneliness, but God has brought you healing from that. And now that past, you have a heart for other people who feel abandoned and lonely, and God's using you to create a home and a place for them. You are just people who bring a sense of safety where people can just rest and be okay around you. Because here's what God does. He takes the brokenness and the evil of this world, he breathes life into it, and then he uses it as a weapon against that brokenness and evil. And some of you tonight might be thinking, like, Josh, you don't understand, you don't know where I've been, and I don't know your story, but there have been some people who have been in some really dark places who have seen God and found him to be faithful in those moments. There's this woman named Corrie Ten Boom who's since passed away, but she's a Holocaust survivor. And saw just about the worst that humanity had to offer, about the worst that this world had to offer. And among several things that she wrote after her experience in that prison camp, she wrote a poem called Life is But a Weaving, and we're actually going to put this up on the screen. And again, this is Corrie Ten Boom, Holocaust survivor. My life is but a weaving between my God and me. I cannot choose the colors he weaveth steadily. Oft times he weaveth sorrow, and I in foolish pride forget he sees the upper and I the underside. Not till the loom is silent and the shuttles cease to fly will God unroll the canvas and reveal the reason why. The dark threads are needful in the weaver's skillful hand as the threads of gold and silver in the pattern he has planned. He knows, he loves, he cares. Nothing this truth can dim. Can you imagine saying that? He gives the very best to those who leave the choice to him. Whenever we are able to look at the story of our life and see it from a God-centered perspective, it breathes resilience into our story. Suffering without a God-centered perspective creates despair. But suffering with a God-centered perspective brings resilience. Because we believe that the God of the universe is not done with our story, that he's able to weave even the darkest threads into the tapestry of something beautiful. For Esther, the call was to look at the tragedy of her life so far and to believe that God could still be at work in it. It was a call to step out into a place where her life would be on the line, even though she had not seen much evidence of late that God was going to come through for her. And out of Esther's obedience, and I would really encourage you, there's so much in the story I can't get into tonight, to go and read it for yourself. But out of Esther's obedience, God used her to bring deliverance to all of the Jewish people. And not just deliverance, but to bless them even more than they were before her. What if you saw the story of your life and rather than seeing the absence of God, believed that God was in the details of the story, breathing purpose into it and bringing something beautiful? I want to close tonight with just one more story. You may have heard in the news recently about a girl named Kayla Mueller, and she is it was a woman who was kidnapped and died recently at the hands of ISIS. And she, a little while before that happened, had managed to get, some people were let go, and she managed to send a letter back home through them. And I don't know if you saw this in the news or if you got a chance to read it, but I just wanted to read one more story of someone who is able to find God in the middle of their suffering. And we'll actually have a picture up on the screen, I think, that just shows that this is actually her handwritten note. I just want to read you a little bit of this. I remember my mom always telling me that all in all, in the end, the only one you really have is God. I've come to a place and experience where, in every sense of the word, I've surrendered myself to our Creator because there was literally no one else. And by God and by your prayers, I have felt tenderly cradled in free fall. I've been shown in darkness light, and I've learned that even in prison, one can be free. I'm grateful. I have come to see there is good in every situation. Sometimes we just have to look for it. I pray every day that if nothing else, you have felt a certain closeness and surrender to God as well, and have formed a bond of love and support among one another. Do you believe in a God who's big enough to not just in the good times, but in the bad times, not just in the blessings, but in the tragedies? Do you believe in a God who is big enough to meet you in the moment of your pain and bring something beautiful, to breathe purpose into the purposelessness and to turn it into something that brings redemption to this world? tonight, would you be willing, whether it's in the goodness or in the darkness, to shift perspectives, to see the other side of the story, and to see that God has been at work, and that maybe at just such a time as this, that God is setting the stage to do something. So tonight, here's how we're going to close. So I'm going to invite you to enter into a time of prayer here in a second, and then after that, we're going to worship together through singing. And I don't know if you noticed this in both Corrie Ten Boom and in Kayla's story that we just read. In both of them, there's this joy that just jumps off of the pages of their writing. And tonight, we are going to choose as a community to move toward gratitude and out of entitlement, or to move out of gratitude or out of a belief that God is at work, and to be resilient and not to fall into despair. And we're going to do that by choosing to worship and to have find joy. And as we do that, God is going to stir our hearts to believe that he is there in the story with us. But before we do that, I'm going to invite us into a time of prayer. So let's pray really quick. And my hope is that for most of us tonight, we've had a moment in our life, something that's come to mind, that God has prompted us to say, yeah, this is where I want to speak into your life right now. And I'm just going to give you space to talk to him about that, whether it's about entitlement, whether it's about hope in the middle of suffering, about finding him again, looking for him in the details of your life. Just have a conversation with God where you talk to him about wherever you sense him speaking to you right now. So God, we choose to look for you in our story. And sometimes the worship flows easily, and sometimes it's hard. But God, tonight we're a community of people. I'll speak for myself. There will be words that we sing, and some of them will be hard for me to say because I don't feel like they've been very true in my life or that I have lived them out very well. God, there will be parts of this worship time that will stretch me to push me to step out of my world and to see you, to find you in my story. But God, I want to choose gratitude tonight. I want to choose to remember and to see you in my story and to not ignore you. And so I pray over our community as we enter into this time of worship. God, would you speak hope and comfort to the hurting? Would you remind the people who are struggling with entitlement? Would you remind them of all the goodness that you have poured out on them? Not out of guilt, not so it produced guilt, so that it would produce gratitude that would motivate them to want to celebrate and praise and look for you. I pray for the people who have just been so busy, they forgot to keep looking for you. That tonight as we worship, that you would be stirring up their heart's affection, their mind's attention toward you. God, tonight as we worship, would you help us to see you in our story?